he was young, put it. He couldn't stand not being somebody, just could not stand it. But he still wouldn't leave the road he had chosen as the best road to the prize he wanted so badly. The governorship, he explained to aides, could never be more than a detour in his route, a detour that might turn into a dead end. Some years later, when his longtime assistant John Connolly decided to run for the governorship, Johnson told him he was making a mistake in leaving Washington. "Here's where the power is," he said. In 1948, still stuck in the House, he was about to turn 40, and a new assistant, Horace Busby, saw that he believed, and he believed it really quite sincerely, that when a man reached 40 it was all over, and there was no bill ever passed by Congress that bore his name. He had done very little in his life. Hopeless though his ambition might seem, however, Lyndon Johnson still clung to it. Instructing Busby to refer to him in press releases as LBJ, he explained, "FDR, LBJ, FDR, LBJ, do you get it? What I want is for them to start thinking of me in terms of initials." It was only presidents whom headline writers and the American people referred to by their initials. He was just so determined that someday he would be known as LBJ, Busby recalls. That year, frantic to escape from the trap that the House had become for him, he entered a Senate race he seemed to have no chance of winning. During the campaign and during post-campaign vote counting, he went beyond even the notoriously elastic boundaries of Texas politics, and won. But the Senate, into which he was sworn in January 1949, was also only a step toward his goal, only the second rung on a three-rung ladder. It was a rung on which he seemed very much at home. Lyndon Johnson was, as I have written, a reader of men. He had promulgated guidelines for such reading, which he tried to teach his young staff members. "Watch their hands, watch their eyes," he told them. "Read eyes. No matter what a man is saying to you, it's not as important as what you can read in his eyes." Teaching them to peruse men's weaknesses, he said that the most important thing a man has to tell you is what he's not telling you. The most important thing he has to say is what he's trying not to say. And therefore, it was important not to let a conversation end until you learned what the man wasn't saying, until you got it out of him. Johnson himself read with a genius that couldn't be taught, with a gift that was so instinctive that one aide, Robert G. "Bobby" Baker, calls it a sense. He seemed to sense each man's individual price and the commodity he preferred as coin. And Johnson also had a gift for using what he read. His longtime lawyer and viceroy in Texas, Edward A. Clark, was to say, "I never saw anything like it." He would listen at them, and in 5 minutes he could get a man to think, "I like you, young fellow, I'm going to help you." Watching Lyndon Johnson play older men, Thomas G. Corcoran, the New Deal insider and quite a player of older men himself, was to explain that he was smiling and deferential, but hell, lots of guys can be smiling and deferential. Lyndon had one of the most incredible capacities for dealing with older men. He could follow someone's mind around and get where it was going before the other fellow knew where it was going. These gifts served Lyndon Johnson better in small groups. Men marveled at his ability to make liberals think he was one of them, conservatives think he was one of them. Since that tactic worked best when there was no member of the other side around to hear, it worked best of all when he was alone with one man. "Lyndon was the greatest salesman one-on-one who ever lived," George Brown was to say. These gifts had gone largely wasted in the House, whose 435 members could be dealt with only in bodies and droves. But the first time Lyndon Johnson walked into the Senate chamber after his election to that body, he muttered in a voice so low that his aide Walter Jenkins, standing beside him, felt he was speaking to himself, that the Senate was the right size. This assessment proved accurate. With 96 men in that body, there were only a relatively small number of texts to be read, and because of senators' 6-year terms, these texts were not constantly changing as they were in the House, and therefore could be perused at length. Some Senate subcommittees had only 3 members. So on these subcommittees, it was literally necessary for the great salesman to sell only one man to obtain a majority for his views. And he rose to power in the Senate with unprecedented speed. In a body previously dominated by the strictures of seniority, he became assistant leader of his party in 1951, 2 years after he arrived there. In another 2 years, still in his first term, he became the party's leader. 2 years later, in 1955, when the Democrats became the majority party in the Senate, Lyndon Johnson became the youngest majority leader in history, the most powerful man in the Senate after just a single term there. The youngest and the greatest. By 1955, in the opinion of its journalistic chroniclers and a growing number of historians and political scientists, the Senate was the joke it had been for decades, only more so. So much an object of contempt that more and more frequently a suggestion was being heard that perhaps the institution might be dispensed with entirely. "Its obsolescence," said the era's most authoritative work on Capitol Hill, George B. Galloway's The Legislative Process in Congress, "may lead the American people in time to recognize that their second chamber is not indispensable." Revolutionizing the Senate, not only pushing long-stalled social welfare legislation through it, but making it for the first time in over a century a center of governmental energy and creativity, Lyndon Johnson brought a 19th century, in many ways an 18th century, institution into the 20th century. The role of leader, legislative leader, was, furthermore, clearly a role he was born to play. As he stood at the leader's commanding front row center desk in the Senate chamber, directing the Senate's actions with the surest of hands, as he strode the aisles of the chamber and Capitol with colleagues addressing him by title, "Good morning, leader. Could I have a minute of your time, leader? Mr. Leader, I never thought you could pull that one off." He was completely in charge, a man at home in his job. His 12 years in the Senate, his wife Lady Bird was to say, were the happiest 12 years of our lives. To him, however, the Senate remained only a rung on the ladder. As was demonstrated in 1956 at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, he had stayed out of the primaries and other pre-convention maneuvering because he had concluded he had no chance to win the party's presidential nomination. But when at the very last moment, on the very eve of the convention, he suddenly came to feel that he did have a chance, he grabbed for the prize. Although his effort lasted only 2 days, the frenzied urgency with which, during these days, he grabbed, deep down he understood the realities, Jim Rowe recalls, but he wanted to be president so much, adds Tommy Corcoran, on most things you could talk sense to Lyndon, but there was no talking to him about this, showed how desperately he wanted it. And when the 2 days were over, and with another 2 days still remaining before the actual balloting, it became clear that the ballot would be only a formality, and that Adlai E. Stevenson of Illinois was assured of an overwhelming victory, Johnson, in the past invariably the most pragmatic of politicians, nevertheless refused to withdraw his name, against all logic, in the face of every pragmatic consideration. His supporters felt they understood the reason. After explaining that Johnson's actions made no sense to anyone, myself included, John Connolly added that in politics, you can always have a dream, that you always have hope, and that Johnson had simply been unable to bring himself to give up his great dream. He wanted it so much he wasn't thinking straight, Corcoran said. Resting up at Brown and Root's hunting lodge in Falfurrias, Texas, after the convention, Johnson spent hours talking to George Brown, who says he hadn't thought he would be so close, and then when all of a sudden he felt he was close, he got carried away with the thought that he might get it, and he simply couldn't bear to just admit he didn't have a chance. That was the explanation, Tommy Corcoran agrees. Johnson hadn't withdrawn because he couldn't bear to. And these men knew he would try again at the next convention in 1960. Standing ankle-deep in discarded sandwich wrappers, coffee containers, and Johnson placards on the convention floor after Stevenson had won, he received 905 votes, Johnson 80. Connolly shouted defiantly, "Don't you worry, this was just a practice run. We'll be back 4 years from now." One obstacle made climbing to the next, the top, the ultimate rung, reaching the prize of which he had so long dreamed, especially difficult for him. He was from the South, from one of the 11 states that had seceded from the Union and formed the Rebel Confederacy, and that, despite America's Civil War almost a century before, still largely denied basic civil rights to their black citizens, to the indignation and anger of the heavily populated northern states, the states whose convention votes determined the Democratic nominee. With growing black protests focusing attention on southern injustice, northern anger against the South was mounting steadily during the late 1950s. No southerner had been elected president for more than a century, since Zachary Taylor in 1848. Andrew Johnson of Tennessee was not elected but completed Abraham Lincoln's term. And it was a bitter article of faith among Southern politicians that no Southerner would be elected president in any foreseeable future. When members of the House of Representatives gave their speaker, Sam Rayburn, ruler of the House for more than two decades, a limousine as a present, attached to the back of the front seat was a plaque that read, "To our beloved Sam Rayburn, who would have been president if he had come from any place but the South." During his first 20 years in Congress, through 1956, Lyndon Johnson's 100% Southern voting record on civil rights, and his work as a Southern strategist, a Richard Russell lieutenant, against rights bills, work that had won him the trust and respect of the Georgia giant so completely that Russell anointed him to one day succeed him, and the Southern bloc raised him to the Senate leadership, had put what one journalist called the taint of magnolias on Lyndon Johnson. In 1956, there had been no realistic possibility that the North would support him for the nomination, or that it would, should he be nominated, vote for him for president. He could never scrub off that taint completely, but during the year following the 1956 disappointment, he managed to remove part of it. Throughout his life, there had been hints that he possessed a true, deep compassion for the downtrodden, and particularly for poor people of color, along with a true, deep desire to raise them up. During his previous career, that compassion, subordinated always to ambition, had revealed itself only in brief flashes, quickly suppressed. But in 1957, compassion and ambition had finally come into alignment, pointing at last in the same direction. His allies in Washington told him bluntly what he already knew, that the crux of the North's animosity to him was its belief that he was opposed to civil rights, and that the only way to dilute that animosity was to pass a civil rights bill. "Consequential action is essential for LBJ," warned a confidential memo he received from his supporter Philip Graham, publisher of the Washington Post. Otherwise, Graham told him, he might wind up his career as only another Southern legislative leader, only to be another Dick Russell. Corcoran, that ultimate Washington insider, was, as always, blunter. He was to recall telling Johnson flatly in 1957 that if he didn't pass a civil rights bill, he could just forget the 1960 nomination. And these warnings were being given to a man who didn't need them. "If I failed to produce on this one," Lyndon Johnson himself said, "everything I had built up over the years would be completely undone." In 1957, he set out to pass a civil rights bill, and when, after months of effort, that attempt seemed to have failed, and he retreated to his ranch as if to avoid being identified with another civil rights defeat, Roe pursued him with a memo warning him that he had no choice but to come back and fight. "This is Armageddon for Lyndon Johnson. I would not like to see the 1960 nomination go down the drain because of 1957. It had been upon receipt of that memo at the ranch that Lyndon Johnson had returned to Washington and, in a monumental feat of legislative maneuvering, of bullying, cajoling, threatening, of lightning tactical decisions on the Senate floor, and of parliamentary genius on a grand scale, including a strategic masterstroke that brought into line behind his efforts in a single transaction a dozen Western senators, had succeeded in persuading his 21 fellow Southern senators, the mighty Southern Caucus, to allow the passage of the first civil rights bill since Reconstruction, 82 years earlier. It was not a strong bill. By the time Johnson had finished fashioning a compromise that the Southerners would accept, provisions that would have enforced school desegregation and banned racial segregation in housing, hotels, restaurants, and other public places, provisions liberals considered essential, had been removed. Only a single civil right, voting, remained, and the provisions for enforcing that loan right proved largely useless. But the mere fact of the bill's passage, that after 82 years in which every civil rights bill that reached the Senate had died there, one had finally been passed, was of historic significance. It opened a major branch of American government to a tenth of the population for which all legislative doors had been slammed shut, Johnson's longtime press secretary, George Reedy, said. And Johnson argued, in a contention that would be vindicated by history, that although there was only one right remaining in the bill, that was the right that mattered, that it gave blacks the power to at least begin fighting for other rights. Furthermore, he pointed out, once a bill was passed, it could be amended to correct its deficiencies. "It's just a beginning," he said. "We'll do it again in a couple of years. Don't worry, it's only the first." Although passage of the 1957 Civil Rights Act did not eliminate the distrust with which liberals viewed him, far from it, his previous record on civil rights was too long and too Southern for that, the bill he had forced through too weak, his Washington allies felt that the sharpest edges of that distrust had been blunted. And as for the Southern senators, a key reason they had allowed the measure to pass was their hope that enactment of a bill with which Johnson was identified might, by lessening Northern distrust of him, enable the South to get its first president in a century. They were confident that as president, Johnson would keep civil rights reform to a minimum. He had, in years of private conversations, convinced the Southerners that in his heart he was on their side. "We can never make him president unless the Senate first disposes of civil rights," Russell had explained to Reedy. So if he ran for the 1960 nomination, expectations were that the 11 Southern states would be solidly behind him. A block of 352 votes out of the 761 needed for nomination in the Democratic Convention. And he had a real chance, political observers said, to go into the convention with a large block of votes from the West as well. Now, at last, was the moment Lyndon Johnson had been waiting for all his life. While Adlai Stevenson was still the idol of many Democratic liberals, his two losses in presidential campaigns disqualified him in the eyes of party professionals, and anyway, he had said quite definitively that he would not be a candidate. The party's perennial hopeful, Estes Kefauver of Tennessee, Adlai's running mate in 1956, was distrusted by these same professionals because of his stubborn independence. And Kefauver, like the other potential candidates, John F. Kennedy of Massachusetts, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, and Stuart Symington of Missouri, was a senator. And he, Lyndon Johnson, was the Senate's leader, their leader, the man they had come to, and had been coming to for years, for every large and small favor in the Senate pantry. As Lyndon Johnson surveyed the field in early 1958, none of these men seemed a particularly formidable opponent. If he won the nomination, furthermore, he would not have to face Eisenhower, since the beloved president would have served the two terms the Constitution allowed. Neither of the two potential Republican nominees, William Noland of California and Eisenhower's vice president, Richard M. Nixon, would be nearly as formidable. Lyndon Johnson had positioned himself as well as was possible for a Southern candidate. Now was the moment to strike. But he didn't. Sometime in 1958, no one involved knows the exact date, he summoned to his LBJ ranch six or seven men who were veterans of previous campaigns, greeted them on the front lawn that sloped down from the house to the little Pernalis River, asked them to pull the lawn chairs into a semicircle around him, and told them he had called them together to discuss his upcoming campaign for the presidency. "He was convinced that he was the best man to be president," recalls one of the group, Texas State Senator Charles Herring, and "he was convinced that he could be nominated and win if we'd work hard enough." "I'm going to be president," he told them. That was his destiny. "I was meant to be president." Having worked for Johnson in earlier campaigns, Herring, for example, had been a part of the first Lyndon Johnson campaign 2 decades before, When he ran for Congress in 1937, and of every campaign since, the other five congressional races and three races for the Senate, the losing campaign in 1941, the legendary 87-vote victory of 1948, and the walkaway of 1954. Joe Kilgore, now a congressman, had worked the Rio Grande Valley for Johnson in 41 and carried it with him in 48 and 54. The men in that group had heard similar speeches at the start of campaigns, of so many campaigns, in fact, that among themselves they had given the speech a name, the sales pitch. No matter what office he had been running for, he would make that pitch that he was going to be president one day, Kilgore recalls. This occasion seemed no different. As Lyndon Johnson sat in front of his big white house under a majestic oak tree, facing the men and the long sloping lawn behind them, wearing a rancher's khaki pants, open-necked shirt, and high boots. The men there remember him, as Kilgore says, leaning out of his chair like he always was. He was a big man, just under 6 feet 4 inches in height, and everything about him was outsized, dramatic. His arms long even for a tall man, his hands huge, mottled, the powerful shape of his massive head emphasized because his thinning, still mostly black hair was slicked down flat on it. His face, unblurred by excess flesh because ever since his 1955 heart attack, he was keeping his weight 30 or 40 pounds below its previous level, was a portrait in aggressiveness. Between the long ears, the sharp-jutting nose, the sharp-jutting jaw, under long, heavy black eyebrows, penetrating, intimidating eyes, so dark a brown that they seemed black. And as he talked, leaning forward out of his chair, his belief in his destiny poured out of Lyndon Johnson with such passion and intensity that, as had been said about him, he was big all right, but he got bigger as he talked to you. And now, on the ranch lawn in 1958, he was very aggressive, Herring says. Anyone who didn't agree with him was wrong. He knew he was going to win. He knew in his own mind that he was destined to be president of the United States. He didn't use the word destined, Herring says. That wasn't a word in his vocabulary. But he used other words that conveyed the same meaning. He told us, I'm going to be president, I was meant to be president, I was intended to be president, and I'm going to be. These men had also heard before some variation of the words Lyndon Johnson spoke next. If we do everything, we'll win, he told them. It was simply a matter of hard work. In every campaign, as in every aspect of his life, Herring, Kilgore, and the other men in the little circle knew, Lyndon Johnson had driven himself, and he had driven his men, reciting that mantra, if we do everything. And now he told them what everything was going to mean in the campaign for the nomination. They would each shortly be assigned a group of states for which they would be responsible, and they would make contact with and try to win to Johnson's side every member of those states' convention delegations. Between them and others who would be brought aboard and assigned responsibility for other states, we were, Herring recalls, going to see every Democratic delegate in the United States. So, having heard similar sales pitches before, they felt they knew what would quickly come next. The list of states to which each of them was assigned, and then the barrage of orders telling them what they were to do to win those states' delegates for Lyndon. Orders that would include details of each delegate's political, personal, and financial situation. And then the follow-up calls from Johnson. The calls, often in the middle of the night, in which he did not bother to identify himself, but simply began, as soon as the telephone receiver was picked up, to ask questions, demand answers. Had this been done? Had that been done? Why hadn't more been done? And to give new assignments. But this time, as month after month passed in 1958, nothing came, not even the list of assigned states. We didn't hear anything at all, Kilgore says. And when, puzzled, they called the two men they normally called when they had questions, John Connolly, who had left Johnson's staff to become attorney for the wealthy oil man Sid Richardson, but who would, Johnson had told them, be running the campaign, and Walter Jenkins, the member of Johnson's staff most able to convey Johnson's thinking, the answers they received were evasive. Oh, he would be running, Connolly and Jenkins told them. Of course he would be running. He just wasn't running yet. But as month followed month, and 1958 drew to a close, and the convention and election year of 1960 drew closer, the assignments were still not forthcoming. Men were puzzled in Washington, too, when a group of attorneys, a dozen leading legal and political minds of the New and Fair Deals, had in 1957 been brought together in the conference room at Corcoran and Rowe to devise wording that would facilitate passage of the Civil Rights Bill. The senior partner of that influential Washington law firm had told them, "You know, we're all pros here and we can talk to each other. We know we're here to elect Lyndon Johnson president." And now, in 1958, with the bill passed, it was, Reedy says, time to move. Hardly had the year begun when the firm's other name partner was sitting in Johnson's office in the Capitol explaining what Johnson had to do. "He had to broaden his support beyond the South," Jim Rowe said, "but the big northern states were controlled by a few bosses, Dick Daley of Illinois, Dave Lawrence of Pennsylvania, Mike DeSalle of Ohio, Carmine DeSapio and Mike Prendergast in New York, John Bailey of Connecticut. To win the support of these hard-eyed men, and of party chieftains in smaller northern states, he would have to demonstrate that although he was a southerner, he could attract support in non-southern states. Not in liberal strongholds like Illinois or Pennsylvania or New York, perhaps, but certainly in the border states, and in the western and Rocky Mountain states. That could only be done," Rowe said, "if he entered some of the Democratic primaries that would be held in 1960. There would be 16 of them, and some of them seemed naturals for Johnson. Indiana, for example, a conservative state with strong ties to the South. And West Virginia, whose junior senator Robert C. Byrd, a Johnson acolyte, was already urging him to run, promising to deliver the state for him. A state so overwhelmingly Protestant that even if a Kennedy candidacy had somehow managed to pick up steam, it would be derailed there. He had to decide which primaries he was going to enter," Rowe said, "and he had to decide quickly. While the primaries might be 2 years away, it was none too early to begin setting up organizations. Statewide organizations, countywide organizations, organizations in each state's individual congressional districts. He had to start immediately making trips to states that would not hold primaries as well as to those that did, meeting the men who would select and in some cases control the delegates who would cast votes at the convention. He had to establish personal relationships with them, personal and other kinds, had to find out what they wanted, what promises of positions in a new presidential administration for themselves or for their allies, of rewards even more pragmatic, would enlist their support, what issues they cared about deeply enough that a candidate's position on them would be a decisive factor in whether or not they supported him. Andrew said it was important to start doing that too as soon as possible, to lock up delegates before they were locked up by someone else. Lyndon Johnson had, George Reedy was to say, an almost mystical belief in Jim's powers because of a memorandum that Rowe had written to President Harry Truman in 1948, at a moment when Truman's re-election campaign looked hopeless. Johnson knew that Truman had kept the memorandum, 32 single-spaced typewritten pages, containing a campaign strategy of great specificity and pragmatism, with every one of its recommendations based not on ideology but on what the memo called the politically advantageous thing to do, in the bottom drawer of his desk in the Oval Office all during the campaign, using it as a blueprint for his come-from-behind victory over Thomas Dewey. Having read it himself, Johnson believed that its brilliance had been proven by Truman's victory. Feeling that Rowe might be able to do the same for him, could give him, too, a blueprint for reaching the goal that flickered always before him, he had often, as in the case of the Armageddon memo, given heavy weight to Rowe's opinions. But this time, when Rowe gave his advice, Lyndon Johnson rejected it. All of it. He wasn't going to enter any primaries, he told Rowe. He wasn't going to run around the country giving speeches. He was going to make no overt move at all to get the nomination. Instead, he was going to stay in Washington and stick to running the Senate. He was going, he said, to tend the store. He had a responsibility to do that, he said. Being majority leader was a full-time job, and he was going to concentrate on that job and simply stay in Washington and do it. The country would see that he was doing it, he said. The country knew what he had accomplished as majority leader and would see that he was doing the responsible thing. He would pick up plenty of non-Southern support without running around the country, he said. He would get that support right out of Washington. For one thing, he had Mr. Sam. The Speaker, he said, had an awful lot of representatives who owed him favors and who wanted favors from him. And he himself, he said, had his senators. He could count on them, he said, senators like Carl Hayden, Mike Mansfield, Clint Anderson, and Dennis Chavez. Old Carl had promised him Arizona. In Montana, he had Mike. Clint and Denny would take care of New Mexico. Let the other candidates run around the country, he said. Since none of them were particularly strong, they would kill each other off in the primaries. None of them had a chance of coming into the convention with anything near the necessary 761 votes. The convention would therefore be deadlocked, he said. And then the party would turn to him, for in the event of a deadlock, the nomination would be decided by the party's bosses. They wanted a winner. They weren't going to go for Adlai, a two-time loser whose indecisiveness had exhausted their patience. They weren't going to go for Hubert. He was so liberal he could never win. Symington was hardly known outside his own state. Kennedy was campaigning all over the country, but he not only was young, 41, but looked much younger, far too young to be a president. Furthermore, he was a Catholic. The veteran big city bosses were Catholics, all of them. Daly, Lawrence, DeSalle, DeSapio, Prendergast, Bailey. They would never put a Catholic at the head of their party's ticket. As Newsweek analyzed their feelings, 30 years have passed since the defeat of Al Smith, but they still remember vividly the violent anti-Catholic feeling which the 1928 campaign engendered. Who would take Kennedy seriously anyway, Johnson said. He knew him from the Senate, and he was little more than a joke there, a rich man's son, a playboy. And he said, sickly to boot, always away from Washington because of some illness or other, and never accomplishing anything when he was present. He never said a word of importance in the Senate, and he never did a thing, he was to say. And he himself would have, between his Southern support and the additional states his senators delivered to him, a substantial block of votes of his own with which to bargain. And the old leaders wouldn't require much persuasion anyway. They knew the importance of experience and responsibility in a candidate. They would go for him. For example, he had already had discussions with DeSapio and Prendergast. He would have plenty of support in the New York delegation. The men to whom Johnson explained this reasoning, and soon he was having to explain it not only to Roe, but to Corcoran and other New Deal lawyers like Ben Cohen and Abe Fortas. I was so anxious for him to announce, Fortas would recall, and to many other men in Washington, felt that it might have a certain degree of validity. His position as leader made him vulnerable if he declared his candidacy. "I'm trying to build a legislative record over there," he told one of Rayburn's assistants, D.B. Hardiman. "The Senate is already full of presidential candidates. If I really get into this thing, they'll gang up on me and chop me up as leader so that I'll be disqualified for the nomination." Speculation over whether he is a candidate merely adds to the burden of his leadership, John Steele of Time magazine explained to his editors on March 4, 1958, in a memo following a conversation with Johnson. But the validity, these men felt, was only to a point. For one thing, Johnson's belief that senators and members of Rayburn's House would control delegations had long been disproved. Senators spent much of their time in Washington, and that made a difference. W.H. Lawrence was to point out in the New York Times that for decades, the congressional bloc has not been dominant in either party's national conventions. In convention delegations, governors, enjoying statewide patronage and constantly on the job at home, usually exercise much more influence than do senators and representatives. In fact, Johnson had seen this for himself. In 1952, another Senate majority leader, Robert Taft, had relied on senators to get him the Republican nomination against Eisenhower, with notable lack of success. And while Johnson may have believed that his triumphs in the Senate had given him national recognition, men like Roe and Corcoran knew that this belief was unfounded. Outside of Washington, people simply weren't that interested in the Senate, didn't even know what a majority leader did. As a Johnson ally explained it to Walter Jenkins, You can cross the Potomac River and get out in the country, and those folks haven't the slightest idea how legislation is brought up. They don't even know that Lyndon Johnson has the power to schedule legislation. Moreover, Johnson's strategy rested on his belief that the bosses would turn to him if there was a deadlock. But they wouldn't turn to him unless he had proven that he could win outside the South. That meant entering the primaries, and Johnson was saying he wouldn't enter any primaries. If he wouldn't do that, there was a slim chance, very slim but nonetheless a chance, that he might be able to demonstrate that he could connect with Northern delegates by going to their states, meeting them, speaking at their meetings. And of course he had to meet and make allies of the bosses themselves, some of whom he had met only once or twice, if at all. But Johnson was saying he wouldn't even do that. "I'm not going to get the nomination by running around with my shirt tail hanging out hollering for it," he said. He refused to do any form of campaigning in northern states. "He said he wasn't going to do anything," Jim Rowe recalls. It wasn't that Lyndon Johnson didn't want the nomination, these men saw. All during 1958, he swung back and forth between his desire for the presidency and his refusal to reach for it. A few days after he was so adamant with one of them, or sometimes on the same day in another conversation with the same man, he would begin talking, endlessly, Corcoran says, about delegate counts, analyzing how he was going to put together the necessary 761, and about the best arguments to use to win over some specific big state leader, analyses that showed them that he wanted the nomination as desperately as ever, that he was thinking constantly about it, and that he understood the need to start taking steps to get it. Nonetheless, all through the year, he drew back from taking any steps. Having seen in 56 how much he wanted it, Rose says, he didn't take seriously Johnson's disavowal of interest, and early in 1958, "I wrote him a memo whose theme was the need to position yourself for 60 without delay." He said that's a good memo, and asked Rowe to expand it into a detailed campaign strategy similar to the one he had written for Truman for winning the Democratic presidential nomination. When in August Rowe told Johnson that the document was nearing completion, Johnson asked him to come to the ranch to discuss it. Just a day or two later, however, with the memo not yet finished, he told Rowe not to bother going on with it. Rowe told Johnson that they both knew he would eventually get in the race, and that if Johnson waited too long, it won't do you any good, you will be doing it too late. Johnson's response was to tell him again that he wasn't going to do anything. And he didn't. Kilgore, who had seen close up how hard Lyndon Johnson worked during campaigns, realized that this time he wasn't really trying. "One so often thinks of Mr. Johnson as being a decisive man," George Reedy was to say. "On most issues he is. On this one he was not. That was a confused period, extremely confused, in which I believe he was a man badly torn." In attempting to explain why he was torn, why he wasn't really trying, in attempting to explain why Lyndon Johnson, who had schemed and maneuvered so endlessly, worked so hard to become president, now when the prize was closer than ever before, when it was perhaps almost within his reach, was refusing to reach for it, the men in both Texas and Washington who had worked longest with Lyndon Johnson came to the same conclusion. Connolly, who had once confided to a friend that he's never had another thought, another waking thought, except to lust after the office, had been told by Johnson that he would be managing the campaign for that office, but he had still been given no campaign to manage. Asked years later for an explanation, Connolly said that as much as he, Johnson, wanted the nomination, he did not want to be tarred with, did not want the stigma of, having lost it. And, Connolly says, if he didn't try, he couldn't fail. Says Jim Rowe, "He wanted one thing. He wanted it so much his tongue was hanging out. Then he had another part inside him that said, 'Why get my hopes up? I'm not going to try. If I don't try, I won't fail.'" And indeed, as the men who had worked with him longest knew, failure, the dread of it, the fear of losing, that is a factor in the equation that makes up the personality of many men, perhaps most men, was a factor possessed of a particularly heavy weight in the very complex equation that was the personality of Lyndon Johnson. When Bobby Baker had first been assigned the job of counting votes for Johnson in the Senate, Walter Jenkins, who, like Connolly, had been working for Johnson since 1939, warned him never to overestimate the number of votes that Johnson would have if he brought a controversial bill to the floor, because then the measure might be defeated, and defeat was something the chief wanted to avoid at all costs. Never, that was the operative word, and Baker learned quickly that the warning had not been overstated. Other senators might want Johnson to make a fight even on an issue on which he might lose, because it would enable them to make a fighting record in behalf of their causes, Baker says. But Pyrrhic victories were not Lyndon Johnson's cup of tea. He saw no value in glorious defeats. Johnson feared losing, Baker was to say. He had a deep fear of being defeated. He always was petrified by that notion. He was, Baker says, haunted by fears of failure. Petrified. Haunted. Strong words, and other men who had known Lyndon Johnson a long time used words equally strong. Luther L.E. Jones, a member of the debate team he coached at Sam Houston High, recalls that when, in the final round of the Texas State Debate Championship tournament, the judges voted against his team, 2-1, Johnson rushed to a bathroom and vomited. He had a horror of defeat, says Jones, who was later to work for Johnson. An absolute horror of it. And the people, his relatives and the residents of Johnson City, who had known Lyndon Johnson longest, who had known him in his boyhood, felt they understood at least something about the roots of that fear. They felt those roots lay in the little house, a shanty, really, a typical Texas Hill Country dog run, two box-like rooms, each about 12 feet square on either side of a breezeway, two smaller shed rooms and a kitchen all connected by a sagging roof, where Lyndon Johnson had lived from the age of 11 until just after his 14th birthday, for it was there that his father had failed. Sam Ely Johnson, Jr. had brought to that dog run not only his family, his gently reared wife, Rebecca, his elder son, Lyndon, Lyndon's brother, Sam Houston Johnson, and their three sisters, but also his dreams, big dreams. The land on which it sat had once bordered the legendary Johnson Ranch, whose corrals in the days of the Texas cattle kingdom had stretched for miles along the banks of the Pernalis River. During the 1860s and 70s, its owners, Lyndon's grandfather, Sam Ely Johnson Sr., and Sam's brother, Tom, had driven huge herds north to Abilene through Indian country, returning with saddlebags stuffed with golden eagles. Sam's wife, Eliza Bunton, a heroine of the hill country, had ridden out alone in front of the herd to scout, a rifle across the pommel of her saddle. The Johnson brothers had gone broke and lost the ranch, but Sam and Eliza had later saved enough money to buy an adjacent 433-acre parcel on the Pernalis, and Sam Ely Jr. had grown up there. In 1919, after his parents' deaths, his eight siblings wanted to sell the place, but Sam, a romantic and a dreamer, wouldn't hear of it. The Pernalis Valley had been Johnson country, he said, and it was going to be Johnson country again. A touch of grandiosity in his nature, and the lure of high cotton prices, which had been soaring for years and seemed likely to continue to do so, he was planning to raise cotton until he made enough money to re-establish a Johnson cattle herd, led him to end a tiresome bidding war by paying far too much for the land, much more than he could afford. At the time he bought the ranch, Sam Ely Jr. had been quite a figure in the hill country. Tall, with a jutting nose and jaw, long ears and piercing eyes, outgoing, friendly, and eloquent. Despite a streak of idealism that made him a fervent populist and put him at odds with the interests who dominated the legislature, during his six terms in the Texas House, he was surprisingly successful in getting bills passed. He and his growing family lived in Johnson City. The town, whose population during Lyndon's high school years was 323, was one of the tiny towns, miles apart from each other, that dotted the vast emptiness of the hill country. A little huddle of houses so cut off from the rest of the world by a sea of land that one of its residents called it an island town. With no paved roads, it took hours to reach Fredericksburg or Austin, even when roads were passable. But the Johnsons' house was comfortable. The Honorable S.E. Johnson, as the local newspaper called him, the only man in Johnson City who always wore a necktie, was for a while so successful in real estatin' that he bought his wife the first automobile anyone in the town had ever owned, and provided her with a chauffeur to drive it. "You can tell a man by his boots and his hats and the horse he rides," he said, and his hand-tooled boots and pearl-gray Stetson were the most expensive money could buy. And his demeanor reminded people of an old hill country saying, "Johnson's always strut, they even strut sitting down." Johnson City was a religious town, fundamentalist, revivalist, hard-shell religious, but everyone knew that Sam believed in the Darwinian theory, that he attended church, on the irregular Sundays on which he attended church, only to please Rebecca, and that he would take a drink now and then, although, as Johnson City knew, sneaking a beer by Jesus is like trying to sneak daylight by a rooster. His financial success brought him respect, and he was so smiling and friendly, always so willing to spend days helping an old rancher get a pension, that he was a popular figure in the little town. All that changed when, in January 1920, Sam moved his family to the ranch. The next years were years of drought, and as Sam's cotton was dying under the blazing hill country sun, so was the cotton market, as prices fell from 40 cents a pound to 8 cents. In September 1922, when Lyndon was 14, Sam had to sell the ranch for whatever he could get, which wasn't nearly enough to cover his debts. The Johnsons moved back to their house in Johnson City, but they were able to keep it only because Sam's brothers periodically made payments on the back interest on the mortgage. Often there would have been little to eat in that house if it hadn't been for the covered dishes neighbors brought. There was no money in the house. The ranch had broken Sam's health, and it was always frail after that. In any small town, a world to itself, such a transformation would have been dramatic. In Johnson City, an unusually isolated town, in which as late as 1922 there was not a movie house or, except for a few outmoded crystal sets, a single radio, its residents' interest in each other, and particularly in the fall of its most famous resident into ruin, was unusually intense. Sam Johnson became, in a remarkably short time, a figure of ridicule, as if Johnson City had been eager to turn against a man whose views, on Darwin, on prohibition, violated deeply held beliefs. He didn't run for re-election, and he probably wouldn't have won anyway. A potential opponent coined a saying, "Sam Johnson is a mighty smart man, but he's got no sense." The remark was first delivered at a political barbecue. Everyone roared. The interests in Austin made sure Sam didn't get a state sinecure. The only job he could find at first was a $2-a-day post as a state game warden. He was to die in 1937 as a penniless bus inspector. The only thing he had to leave his children was a gold watch and a legacy of the townsfolk's sneers. He couldn't pay what he owed to the local merchants, and he and his wife and children had to walk every day past stores whose owners were writing "please" on the bills they sent every month. They had cut him off from further credit, so that he had to shop, and to run up bills, which he also couldn't pay, in other towns. A remark made by the Johnson City druggist soon gained wide circulation. "Sam Johnson," the druggist said, "is too smart to work and not smart enough to make a living without working." His wife's education, she was the only woman in the area with a college degree, and pretensions, her inability, for example, to work in the fields like other hill country wives, now made her almost a joke, too. And the children of Sam and Rebecca shared in their shame. One of Lyndon's classmates at Johnson City High School, Truman Fawcett, was sitting on his uncle's porch one day when Lyndon walked by. "He'll never amount to anything," the uncle said loud enough for Lyndon to hear. "Too much like Sam." The Johnsons were, for the rest of Lyndon's boyhood, the laughingstocks of Johnson City. The scar that his father's failure left on Lyndon Johnson was shown by the way he talked about it. "We had great ups and downs in our family," he would recall. "One year we'd be riding high in Johnson City terms, But then 2 years later we'd lose it all. We had dropped to the bottom of the heap. Once in later years, a reporter asked him about life on the ranch. "We lived there just long enough to go broke," he replied. And the depth of the scar was perhaps shown even more clearly by the rarity of such remarks. Lyndon Johnson very seldom talked about his youth. Or to be more precise, very seldom talked about it frankly. He tried to conceal its circumstances by weaving, for journalists and biographers, a mythical boyhood, a tapestry of anecdotes, told with the vividness and plentiful detail of a great storyteller that, as his brother sums up, never happened. No transformation caused by Sam Ely's failure was more complete than the one it affected in his relationship with his elder son. Before the Johnsons moved to the ranch, the relationship had been strikingly close. When Lyndon was a little boy, his favorite outfit was one that made him look like his father, right down to a scaled-down version of Sam's big Stetson hat. Lyndon imitated his father, tagged along with him everywhere, right by the side of his daddy wherever he went, an aunt says. When Lyndon was 10, Sam began taking him to Austin. "I loved going with my father to the legislature," Lyndon would say. "The only thing I loved more was going with him during his campaigns for re-election. We drove in the Model T Ford from farm to farm, up and down the valley, stopping at every door. My father would do most of the talking, local gossip, talk about the crops and about the bills he'd introduced. And always he'd bring along an enormous crust of homemade bread and a large jar of homemade jam. We'd stop by the side of the road. He sliced the bread, smeared it with jam, and split the slices with me. I'd never seen him happier. Families all along the way opened up their homes to us. Christ, sometimes I wished it could go on forever." Other children in Johnson City remember how, when they were playing outside, Lyndon and his father would be sitting together in the swing on the Johnsons' screened back porch, holding long conversations, friendly conversations. Those were the only times that I ever saw Lyndon quiet and relaxed. By the time Lyndon was 13 or 14 and about 6 feet tall, there was a particularly conspicuous aspect of the resemblance between them. The tall man with the big ears and nose was very physical in conversation. His arm would go around the shoulders of the legislative colleague to whom he was talking. His other hand would grasp the man's arm or lapel. His face would bend very close to him. Legislators saw Sam's son adopting the same technique. "He was a gangling boy, very skinny," Wright Patman would recall. "He had the same huge ears, the same big nose, the same pale skin, and the same dark eyes, and Lyndon clutched you like his daddy did when he talked to you. He was so much like his father that it was humorous to watch." Legislators saw what playmates saw, a quite unusual bond between father and son. After Sam's fall, and the change was so dramatic that, as the first volume of this work relates, it is possible to date it, his relationship with Lyndon was very different, cold, hostile in fact, with Lyndon refusing his father's requests and orders, defying him so blatantly that, legislators say, he wouldn't pay attention to anything his father wanted. It was at this time, too, the time during which his father was failing on the ranch, that Lyndon began making the prediction. It was at the school he attended when he was 13, the tiny school in the little village of Albert, 4 miles away, that he first began making it. A classmate, Anna Itz, remembers that during a recess, when a group of children were sitting under a hackberry tree near the school, all of a sudden Lyndon looked up at the blue sky and said, "Someday I'm going to be President of the United States." We hadn't been talking about politics or the presidency or anything like that. He just came out with it. Mrs. Itz says that the other children laughed at him and said they wouldn't vote for him, and Lyndon replied, "I won't need your votes." In the opinion of men and women who were children with Lyndon Johnson, his father's fall affected him all his life. His brother, Sam Houston, says that the most important thing for Lyndon was not to be like Daddy. That feeling had several dimensions. For example, Sam Ely was an idealist, a romantic, a dreamer, a man who had no sense. It was important, terribly important, to Lyndon that he be regarded as a man who scorned ideals and causes as impractical dreams, that he be regarded as pragmatic, cynical, tough, shrewd. But another dimension had to do with Lyndon's feelings about failure and defeat. His father's fall had shown him that failure could mean not merely failure, but terror, the terror of living in a house that month by month you were afraid would be taken away from you by the bank. That failure could mean not merely terror, but ruin, permanent ruin. That failure, defeat, might be something from which you would never recover. And failure in public, failing in a way that was visible, having to move off your ranch, having your credit cut off at stores you had to walk past every day, no longer holding your public office, could mean a different, but also terrible kind of pain, embarrassment, disgrace, humiliation. When in 1948 the place he had wanted so long, a seat in the United States Senate, finally opened up, Johnson had not leapt at the opportunity as his allies had expected him to do, but instead had vacillated endlessly until it was almost too late to enter the race, agonizing over the decision as to whether or not to run. His allies had finally threatened to run John Connally instead of him to nerve him up to announce his candidacy. And those men understood what was holding him back. Lyndon Johnson had long been in the habit, in times of crisis, of telephoning Ed Clark, the secret boss of Texas, at 6 o'clock in the morning to discuss the situation and ask for advice. And in 1948, in those calls, Ed Clark heard over and over one word. Humiliation, Clark would recall. That was what he kept repeating. I'll be humiliated. I'll be ruined. If I run, I'm going to lose. I'll be humiliated. Now, in 1958, a race for a much greater prize stretched before him, a race for a prize so vast that the attention not just of a state but of an entire country would be focused on it. So the possibility of defeat, of humiliation, loomed before him larger than ever, and if he didn't try, he couldn't fail. So he didn't try. On the Senate floor in 1958, he was the same as he had always been, a man in command. From the moment just before noon each day, when he pushed open the tall double doors at the rear of the chamber so hard that they swung wide as he strode through them, and came down the four broad steps to the front row center majority leader's desk. No assistant accompanied him as he walked down to the little clutch of journalists waiting for him in the well below his desk. He knew all the details himself, the intricacies of bills, not only major bills, but minor ones, too, the number that each bill had been assigned on the Senate calendar, where in the subcommittee or full committee approval process it stood at the moment, what new amendments had been added to the bill or defeated that day, and why they had been added or defeated, what the arguments on each side had been, when the bill would be brought to the floor for a vote. And there was never any question of him making a slip and giving the journalists information he didn't want them to have. "You didn't get any more than Lyndon Johnson wanted to tell you," one of them says. "Never." He knew exactly what he wanted to say, and that was what he said, period. I never felt in all those years that he ever lost control of one of those briefings. He was always in charge. In charge, in command, journalists said about him. In part, they say, it was because of the aura around him. What one of the journalists says was, the knowledge we had of what this guy had done, of what this guy could do, of what he wanted to be. But there was something more. As another reporter says, power just emanated from him. There was that look he gave. There was the way he held his head. Even if you didn't know who he was, you would know this was a guy to be reckoned with. You would feel, don't cross this guy. He would look around the chamber. It was like he was saying, this is my turf. Prowling the chamber during debates, he would put a long arm around a senator, grasp his lapel firmly with the other hand, put his face very close to his colleagues as he tried to persuade him. His hands never stopped moving, patting a senator's shoulder, straightening a senator's necktie, jabbing a senator's chest, gesturing expressively, his face breaking into a grin if the senator agreed to the proposition being made, turning cold and hard if he didn't. He would be snatching a tally sheet out of Bobby Baker's hands, or dispatching Bobby on an errand, grabbing his shoulders and shoving him violently up the aisle if he wasn't moving fast enough. rasping at the assistant of some other senator who was still back in the Senate office building, "Get your fucking senator over here." During votes, he controlled the very rhythm of the roll call. For some reason, perhaps all his senators were present and there were absentees on the other side, he might want the roll call to be fast, before anything could change. Or if he didn't have all his men there, he wanted the vote to be slow. Standing at that front row desk, towering over the well, dominating the chamber of the Senate of the United States, Lyndon Johnson would raise his right hand high in the air and make revving up circles to hurry the clerk through the names, or make a downward shoving motion with his hands, meaning, slow down. For all the world, as Time said, like an orchestra conductor leading the Senate as if it were an obedient orchestra. It was a splendid sight, the journalist Hugh Sidey would recall years later. This tall man with his mind attuned to every sight and sound and parliamentary nuance. He signaled the roll calls faster or slower. He'd give a signal and the door would open and two more guys would run in. My God, running the world. Power enveloped him. And one of the key elements in Lyndon Johnson's command of this world, the Senate world, was his decisiveness. During the previous 4 years of his majority leadership, the situation would not be ended until a Democratic landslide in November 1958. He was usually operating with a mere one-vote margin, and in a Senate in which both parties contained differing, hostile blocs, the vote on proposed measures was constantly shifting, changing. Amendments that could alter the balance were constantly being introduced, so a leader had to know the moment at which to allow or not allow an amendment, or the moment at which, if he called a bill to the floor, it would pass, to know the moment and to seize the moment. Month after month, year after year, when those moments came, Lyndon Johnson knew them and seized them with a decisiveness so quick and firm that it obviously came naturally to him, that it was obvious that deciding, acting, was something he enjoyed doing, something that he had the will, the desire, the need to do. And in his office after the day's session, in that incredible office with its desk up on a low pedestal so that he sat higher than his guests, and its spotlight in the chandelier focused on his chair, that office so opulently furnished that it was nicknamed the Emperor's Room and the Taj Mahal. He was in 1958 the same as always, too, holding court for senators and favored journalists, with his feet clad in either highly polished black shoes or elaborately hand-tooled LBJ boots, up on his desk, and a glass of scotch in his hand. He would hold it out, rattling the ice in it, to summon a pretty secretary for a refill. He would dominate the conversation as he recounted the day's triumphs and the next day's strategy, at ease, confident, purposeful, assured. Except when the subject turned to the presidential nomination. George Reedy or Walter Jenkins might bring in a sheaf of speaking invitations. They were pouring into Johnson's office every day from all over the country. The boots would come off the desk, and Lyndon Johnson would begin to pace back and forth around the office. Or he would walk over to the window, plunge his hands into his trouser pockets, and stand looking out for long minutes, his tall figure silhouetted against the fading late afternoon light, very still, except that his assistants would hear a continual low jingle as his hands restlessly shuffled the coins and keys in his pockets. Returning to the desk, he would agonize over each invitation, unable to decide whether or not to accept it, at one moment saying he would, the next moment changing his mind, wavering back and forth. Almost always, he wound up declining even invitations that a candidate, even an unannounced candidate for the presidency, would obviously be well advised to accept. Among the 17 invitations to deliver major speeches he received during March 1958, were personal requests from the Grand Dame of his party, Eleanor Roosevelt, for a speech before the American Association for the United Nations, and from the governor of Iowa, Herschel C. Lovelace, who had recently announced that he had not decided whom his state's delegation would support in 1960. Sometimes Johnson would accept one or another invitation, but then invariably would change his mind and refuse, as he did eventually with every one of the 17 March requests, and then would regret that he had refused. Finally, in October, he agreed to visit six states in which Democratic candidates for the Senate were involved in tight races. And he told Reedy to set up small private meetings in his hotel suite after each appearance so that he could meet local political leaders. But at these meetings, he told the leaders he had come to their state strictly in his capacity as Senate Majority Leader to help the Democratic senatorial candidate get elected. When they asked him if he would be a candidate for president, he said he would not, and said it so emphatically that they believed him. And then, as soon as he returned to Washington, he, in secret, took a step in the opposite direction. While in Tennessee, he had spoken at a Democratic fundraising dinner that brought in $10,000 for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Instead of having the money used in Tennessee, he directed the committee's chairman, Senator George Smathers, to have it sent to West Virginia to be used by Democratic officials who would have influence in that state's 1960 Democratic primary, and to make sure the officials knew the money was coming at his, Johnson's, direction. He told Smathers he wanted the committee's resources husbanded for the moment, so they could be used in 1960. All through 1958, Johnson wavered between his yearning for the prize and his fear of being seen to yearn for it. His explanations for not becoming an active candidate, for not traveling to other states to rally delegates and leaders to his cause, varied widely. One day he would give someone the tending the store explanation, saying he wouldn't campaign, at least not for a while, because that was the best strategy to win the nomination. He was going to remain the responsible leader above the fray, minding the nation's business, while the other candidates killed themselves off in the primaries. Then, when the party was deadlocked, it would turn to him. Time magazine's Hugh Seide, who spoke to Johnson frequently during this time, says that he had decided that being above the battle was the big thing. The next day, or to someone else the same day, he would say he didn't want the nomination, that the South's power was on Capitol Hill. "This is my home," Corcoran recalls him saying. "This is where we have our strength." And that he had decided to stay there in the Senate. On other occasions, he said he wasn't running because it was impossible for him, for anyone from the South, to win the nomination, that he was tarred not only with being a Southerner, but, despite his refusal of Charles Marsh's offer, with being an oil man as well, since he had supported legislation benefiting his state's oil interests. Even if he received the nomination, the North would never accept him, and he could not possibly win the election. Therefore, he would not allow himself even to be drafted. If he was drafted, he said, he would refuse. His decision, he would say on these occasions, was final. The year was summed up in his relationship with Roe, who kept urging him to run. But he didn't do anything, said he wasn't going to do anything. This went on for a long time. Any reasons? Just that he couldn't make it. My argument was that you certainly can't make it if you do nothing. The harder Roe pushed, however, the more adamant Johnson became. A few days after the end of the year, Roe finally gave up in a way that dramatized the validity of at least one aspect of his warning. He had been telling Johnson that one reason he couldn't wait, that while he could say publicly that he wasn't a candidate, he had to let party insiders, men with influence or power over other delegates, know that he would announce his candidacy when he judged the time right, was that these insiders were choosing up sides. Many of them favored him, Roe said, but for these political pros, not having a candidate in the race was an unsupportable idea. If he convinced them he wouldn't be a candidate, they would select someone else. He himself was in that situation, Roe had been warning him. "I finally said, I want to get into the campaign, and if you're going to go, let's go. If you aren't, I'm going over and join Humphrey." I talked this way to him for 2 or 3 months, and he said, "I'm not going. You can count on it. I'm not going to run." "I think you are making a mistake," Roe wrote him, "but I will not press you again." He signed up with Humphrey, and the day after Roe's decision was announced in the press, Johnson had a few words on the subject with Tommy Corcoran. "Jim betrayed me," he said. "He betrayed me." He was going to need Jim when, at the proper time, he stepped in to get the nomination, he said, and now Jim wasn't going to be available. Corcoran tried to point out that he had told Roe something else. But Corcoran says, "You couldn't reason with him." Had it not been for one factor, Lyndon Johnson's strategy, whatever its roots, calculation, or fear, might have worked. Johnson did, after all, possess a number of assets the other candidates did not. A solid, substantial block of delegates, the South's, that would be behind him when the convention started, the support of his senators and of Sam Rayburn. And the fact that each of the other contenders had at least one major liability, Humphrey's extreme liberalism, Symington's lack of national recognition, Stevenson's and Kefauver's previous losses, while Kennedy had two, his youth and his Catholicism, made Johnson's belief that none of them would be able to command a majority on early ballots seem, at the beginning of 1958, well-founded. As did his belief that therefore the convention would be deadlocked and thrown into the hands of the big